They have published some of the most well-known authors in the Southern movement, from the Kennedy brothers to Jimmy Cantrell. Pelican Publishing Company has an incredibly diverse library of over 1,300 titles to their credit, with about 60 new titles published annually. If you like books about history, literature, humor, Cajun cooking, travel, or just about anything else, Pelican's website, ePelican.com, is the place for you. With online catalogs and secure online shopping, it's never been easier to tap into the wealth of knowledge and reading pleasure that Pelican has to offer. At ePelican.com, you can browse all of the Pelican's titles and shop for just the right book for yourself or a gift for someone else. Treat yourself today. Visit ePelican.com. That website again, ePelican.com.
All right, welcome to another Pelican Pages segment here at Dixie Broadcasting Radio. We are very pleased on many Wednesday nights to be able to bring you these Pelican Pages segments in which we highlight new books that are coming out, usually new books, sometimes older titles that are published by Pelican Publishing Company. And tonight is no different. We are live here on the broadcast with John Remington Graham, and he's given us permission to call him Jack tonight. So we're here with Jack to talk about his new book that's been recently published by Pelican, entitled Blood Money, The Civil War and the Federal Reserve. And in just a minute, we'll get into the interview and talk to Jack here live on the broadcast. Before we do that, though, I do want to let you know that you can look at the book we're going to be talking about tonight on the Pelican website during the broadcast. All you need to do is go to the Pelican website, which is ePelican.com, and at the top of the website there, you'll see a little link that says Browse. If you'll click on the tab there for Browse, it'll give you the opportunity to enter in either the author's name, John Remington Graham, G-R-A-H-A-M, or you can enter part of the title of the book, Blood Money. And if you put in the title of the book, Blood Money, it'll bring it right up there. You can read a brief rundown on the book while we're talking about it, and you can actually even purchase it at a reduced rate on the Pelican website while the interview is going on. So take a look at the Pelican website there. We're talking with John Remington Graham about his new book, Blood Money, The Civil War and the Federal Reserve. So, Jack, welcome to the broadcast tonight.
Thank you.
Well, Jack, if you would, get us started. I know that you are either a former or a current trial lawyer, but tell us a little bit more about where you're from and your background, and then also how you became interested in this particular topic, if you would.
Well, I'm still practicing law. I've been practicing for about 40 years. I'm a former law professor and a founding professor at the law school at Hamline University. I'm a former public defender and a former public prosecutor, and I practiced in about 16 states. And I'm an expert in forensic medicine. That's the art of presenting medical facts to juries or to courts. And I'm very much interested in legal history. I used to teach legal history. And so that is, in a nutshell, my background. It's quite a long background, but I've been around for quite a while, and I'm just now having at a point in my career when I can do more writing. So my book on Blood Money, the Civil War and the Federal Reserve, was written as a result of a long series of experiences that I had as a lawyer that actually began around 1980. During that time, there were a lot of farmers in the upper Midwest. I'm from Minnesota, which is in the upper Middle West, and as you know, and at that time, and I'm sure it was true in the South too, there were a number of farmers that were being suffering a mortgage foreclosure crisis. And one of my law students asked me to speak at a group in Colorado, and that got me into the business of defending farmers. When I was defending farmers in the mortgage or agricultural mortgage foreclosure crisis during the 1980s, I came to see that the whole crisis had been artificially created. Here we had farmers that were producing record yields. They were should have been very prosperous, but they were suffering this tremendous onslaught of foreclosures by large financial institutions, including the so-called farmer help banks that were set up by the federal government. I began to look into this, realized that it was an artificially created crisis. That in turn got me into the study of money and banking. Of course, I had always been interested in it. My father was a banker and an economist. But I became exceedingly interested and then began to get into the whole question of high finance. That was my introduction to this. At the same time, I had always been a student of the American Civil War, or the war between the states, or the war for Southern independence, depending on which title you particular or your term you prefer to use. They're actually all correct. But I've always been highly interested in that. Interestingly, from a Southern sympathetic point of view, it seems odd because I was from Minnesota. But I had my family has a kind of an odd background. My it goes back. we trace back to the founding of New England. I had an ancestor who came over on the Mayflower, but at the same time, my mother's family married into the South. So I had an aunt from Alabama and an uncle from Alabama by marriage. And that, so I came to understand both cultures and both sides of the story. And I had always been interested in that, and I never could make any sense out of why that war was fought. We've been taught to believe that it was either protective tariffs or slavery or secession or something like that. But I never was able to really fully explain this conflict until I got into the question of money and banking. And I stumbled upon the writing at that time when I was working on the agricultural mortgage foreclosure crisis. I stumbled upon Charles Lindbergh Sr., who was the father of the famous aviator, and he was a member of Congress, probably Minnesota's greatest statesman, but somewhat enigmatic. I grew up about 30 miles north of Little Falls, where Congressman Lindbergh came from, and eventually, I came across his book, his book on the Federal Reserve, and that explained his opposition to the Federal Reserve system. Never could understand how he felt until I actually began to find his material. And he had been somewhat suppressed, but he had the basic insights. That the war between the states was actually provoked during the 1850s by a series of crises. You're probably familiar with, you know, the publication of mass marketing of Uncle Tom's Cabin,
right.
The repeal of the Missouri Compromise, the Kansas Civil War that followed like day follows night, then the Dred Scott case.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Brown's raid and the split in the Democrats in Charleston and Baltimore. All of these crises that seem very difficult to connect were actually orchestrated. And the purpose of the orchestration was to start up a war. And the war was started up because they knew that it would enhance the national debt very substantially. And the idea of running up the national debt was then to convert the debt into bonds and then the bonds into a new and obligatory capital basis, the principal and obligatory capital basis of a new and privileged system of banks that, under the National Bank Acts of 1863 and 1864.
The same national bank that Andrew Jackson had worked so hard to kill just 30 years before that.
Well, no, that was the Bank of the United States. That was a different. That was connected with Washington and Hamilton. This system, the national bank system, was actually was something far more insidious than the Bank of the United States. This was a system of banks that was the primary capital basis were war bonds represented debt incurred from fighting the war. The only ones that could buy these bonds in sufficient quantity to capitalize banks were domestic and international financiers: Jay Cook, August Belmont, who were hooked up with Junius Morgan and whose son J.P. Morgan you've no doubt heard of.
Yes, sir.
And then the Rothschild, the House of Rothschild as well, and other large financial institutions in Europe. The idea was to get control of this new system of banking currency that had certain advantages. Only they had power to issue banknotes, and the state banks used to have to keep their reserves with them, and they were eventually centered in Wall Street. It all started from the financing of the war, and this financial empire with this new and privileged system of banks were the product of the American Civil War. I ended up finding out that the principal consequence of the war was a loss of monetary independence by the United States and the development of an invisible government, if we want to call it, is what Charlie Lindbergh called it. Mm-hmm. Remember, he was a Republican congressman from Minnesota. He got this insight, and he was a lawyer. He was like myself, a trial lawyer, and he was a public prosecutor, as I was, for a long time. So we had a lot of things. Charlie Lindbergh and myself had a lot of things in common. I eventually branched out, learned about a Copperhead lawyer, lived at the time of the Civil War. His name was Henry Clay Dean. Then a famous economist, Alexander Del Mar, and more recently I learned about a Southerner J.B. Jones, John Beecham Jones, who wrote the famous diary, Rebel War Clerk's Diary. I don't know whether you're familiar with that.
Yes,
but
sir.
But it is a leading work on what was going on inside the Confederate government during the war. He also understood the financial manipulations that induced the war, and it was all planned. It was planned to create a national debt and then convert the bond into the new capital basis of a privileged system of banks centered in Wall Street, which was eventually legalized and formalized in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Charlie Lindbergh was famous for his opposition to the Federal Reserve Act, and it was the curious experience that I had had. Law students of mine brought me into the mortgage foreclosure crisis against farmers during the 1980s, and it was that connection that brought me into Lindbergh. It took me about 20 years to finally understand this, and I produced a monograph at the request of a number of individuals who had read my book, Constitutional History of Secession. They were interested in the theme in that book of how the financial causes of the war were brought about. It had nothing to do with secession. Interestingly, the North had in New England had probably the most distinguished secessionist tradition in the country, even more so than the South. It wasn't about slavery, because the only really significant anti-slavery movement in the country was a Southern movement. I eventually learned about the Virginia slavery debates of 1832, mm-hmm. Led by Thomas Jefferson Randolph, who was a nephew of Thomas Jefferson, and James McDowell, who later became governor of Virginia. These were Southerners that led, that represented a real abolitionist sentiment. The sentiment in the North was largely indifferent, and the abolitionist movement in the North was made up of cranks, for the most part. people like Harriet Beecher Stowe and characters of that sort that really had no background or understanding of the problem, and were not really serious about getting rid of slavery. They're more showmen than anything else. Mm-hmm. But the real abolitionists, the ones who were seriously interested in getting rid of slavery, were all Southerners. We don't think of Robert E. Lee as an abolitionist, but if you read J.B. Jones' diary, he explains that Robert E. Lee was regarded as a thoroughgoing emancipationist, as he was called. He was an abolitionist himself. There were all the great abolitionists at that time were Southerners. The Northern movement had degenerated pretty far, and an abolitionist from Alabama by the name of Bernie, I can't think of his name. He sold his slaves and went up north and ran for president a couple of times. This is how we ended up. So it wasn't slavery, because the only anti-slavery movement was in the South. The most interesting theory probably was about protective tariffs, and I was thought for a long time that perhaps this war had something to do with tariffs. Certainly the secession crisis, or the nullification crisis in South Carolina in 1832-1833, was induced by maladjusted tariffs. But the last of the protective tariffs were abolished in 1857. And the South had plenty of influence in the U.S. Senate if they had chosen to stay in the Union to block renewal of tariffs, so that the traditional culprits in this war of trying to explain why we had the war, slavery, secession, and protective tariffs, simply don't add up. The only theory that really makes any sense, and that is verified by circumstantial evidence that you can trace, are the financiers that provoked a series of crises, that antagonisms between the North and the South, with a view to provoking secession and a civil war, so that they could generate a national debt, the bonds from which were used as a capital basis for a new system of and privileged system of banking. That's essentially what happened.
And
it took a long time to figure it out, and a long time to write it. And the book is not very long; it's only about 96 pages. This particular thing is because I was focusing on a particular theme.
And a very readable book too. Let me stop you right here, Jack. In just a minute, when we come back from the break, I want to talk about some of these events that these men intentionally orchestrated that led up to the war, and then some of those events that they used in their money takeover during and following the war, and maybe even maybe you can even point out who some of those men actually were.
Sure.
Folks, we're talking to John Remington Graham, who is the author of a brand new book from Pelican Publishing entitled Blood Money: The Civil War and the Federal Reserve. This is a view of history, a part of history that was going on at the time that you won't find in your high school or college textbook. It is the things that were going on behind the scenes, how the money men in America and beyond were orchestrating events in American history that directly led to the war and the takeover of America's financial system. This is a book that any student of the war would enjoy, but also anyone who's interested in liberty and the restoration of our liberty ought to take a serious look at. Folks, you can take a look at this book by going to the Pelican website, that's epelican.com, and type in the title, Blood Money, and you'll be able to pull it up and look at it. We're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll finish talking to Jack about some of these other things related to how these men actually orchestrated some of those events. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
All right.
You're listening to Dixie Broadcasting, the powerful new voice of today's Southern movement.
Do you want a custom, professionally designed website that communicates your message, sells your product, and gets results? CompTonMedia.com will help you easily develop your web presence by getting you on the internet quickly and worry-free, providing a no-hassle total package for your business or organization, including state-of-the-art hosting services, domain registration, search engine submission, interactive content, and more. Maintaining your website so you can focus on what you do best, whether your website needs new information added once a month or weekly updates, we can make it happen. So if you need a hassle-free web presence that gets results, contact us today. CompTonMedia.com. Expect more. Visit our website today at CompTonMedia.com.
A famous writer once said, talent alone cannot make a writer. There must be a man behind the book, by birth and quality. As the only major Southern publishing house, Pelican Publishing believes that there is something valuable about our Southern way of life, about who we are, and about this place we call home, something worth putting down in written word on the printed page for future generations. Pelican Publishing is proud of our contribution to helping preserve the history and heritage and culture of the South, and we welcome submissions from authors new and experienced here at Pelican. Our family of authors includes some of the best-known names in Southern heritage today, plus a whole lot more. So whether it's about history or heritage, travel or trees, cooking or culture in general, if it's about the South, Pelican should be your first choice. Visit our website at epelican.com to find out about submitting your own book for consideration. Pelican Publishing, giving Southern authors a better choice. And that was Mr. Rick Revel, who is the recipient just Monday night of the President's Award here at Dixie Broadcasting in the 2007 Southern Heritage Music Awards that we hosted the live program Monday night. So congratulations to Rick Revel on that. I'm Ray McBerry. I'm your host for this Pelican Pages segment, and we're talking tonight with John Remington Graham about his new book from Pelican Publishing entitled Blood Money: The Civil War and the Federal Reserve. And Jack, this is a tremendous book. I don't think I've ever heard anyone before lay out in as neatly done a fashion as you have, of showing in a very convincing way how the moneyed men not only brought the war about, but used it then to take over the entire financial system of America. So thanks for the book. Thanks for taking time to put it together and put all the pieces together for those of us that knew what some of the pieces were, but not exactly how they all fit together.
It's a very difficult thing to put all this stuff together and finally see the connections. One reason why it's so difficult is that we don't we're not inclined to accept what is sometimes called a conspiratorial view of history. to think that people would actually get together in rooms and plan things and actually make them happen. People think that that kind of view of history is paranoid or rather odd, but actually, if you don't understand that the great movements of history are planned, you end up with a very naive view of history and are unable to connect the dots and understand what's going on.
Well, you're right. I have a preacher friend who says there are really only two views of history. There's the coincidental view and the conspiratorial view. You either believe everything happened by accident, or you believe that there's someone who's been conspiring against God's plan for mankind since before the foundations of the earth.
Well, that's about right. It sounds that puts it down in perhaps terms that are a little bit oversimplified, but that's about what it amounts to in the end. If you try to imagine that things just happen by accident, and then test it after you've accumulated enough knowledge, it doesn't pan out. There has to be a plan, and the way you have to look at history is in terms of the legal theories that for proving conspiratorial torts, malicious interference with prospective advantage, you have to prove up normally by way of circumstantial evidence. There is a body of law that outlines the nature of the proof. Well, if you apply those theories that are used in court cases for proving up conspiracies and apply them to history, then history falls together and you can see what has happened. I mean, we have a conspiracy to elect a president every 4 years.
Well, that's right.
And that's only the beginning. Well, then you have to just keep on systematically applying that. And you have to keep on making yourself, working on avoiding carrying yourself too far or allowing yourself to become too obsessed with this point of view. It requires a lot of discipline to have a balanced and calm viewpoint about this. But unless you do allow for the activities of men in shaping events, you're going to not understand what history is all about.
Well, you've certainly done a very convincing job of putting the evidence together in the book Blood Money. And I know that the enemy, he really uses the same tactics that he's used for centuries. The enemy of liberty is certainly a master of using the old Hegelian dialectic, creating a crisis situation so that he then in turn provides two plausible solutions, neither of which end up with more liberty. They always end up with the common man having less liberty and more centralized power going to the moneyed men.
It's the story of the French Revolution.
It certainly is.
I mean, if you try to study French Revolution by the standard sources, you read Lord Acton and Thomas Carlyle and so on, it doesn't hang together. You have to finally get to somebody like Nesta Webster, who finally gives you the insight into the French Revolution and explains why things happened as they did. And otherwise, you're not going to be having a good appreciation of events and why they happened.
Well, Jack, if you would, tell us some of the events that were orchestrated by the moneyed men that led up to the war between the states, the war of northern aggression, if I can use that term.
Sure.
And
that's what it was.
And how did they orchestrate those events and use them to bring about the war itself?
Well, let me start out. Well, I think everyone will understand, would appreciate, who understands the events leading to the war would agree that the repeal of the Missouri Compromise and the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 was an important event that led to the eventual secession of the southern states and then the outbreak of the war. The reason why that was important was that it inflamed antagonism between the North and the South. It led to a civil war in Kansas in which Northerners and Southerners were already on the battlefield against each other. How did that happen? Most people, most American historians focus on Stephen Douglas and squatter sovereignty and so on and so forth. They miss the whole point of how that happened. And I learned about it from reading Sir Winston Churchill, his History of the English-Speaking People, in the fourth volume, where he talks about the events leading to the American Civil War. There were big money men in Philadelphia, New York, and Boston who were interested in building a transcontinental railroad taking the central route. And that's where they had invested their money. And they did not want to build one. There was actually the more advantageous route, the more feasible route was through the South from New Orleans to San Diego. But the big money men had already planned the central route. And what they did was to convince to get the Southerners to support this route. They gave them an opportunity, or actually a false opportunity, to make Kansas a slave state, and this was used only as the bait to get enough Southern support to build the railroad along the southern route, or the central route. Of course, there was no possibility that slavery was going to be established in the territories, as is evidenced by the fact that in 1860 there were in all of the federal territories exactly 17 slaves. Most people think that there must, that for all the controversy that slavery in the territories generated, that there must have been some thousands, many thousands of slaves in the territory. There were only 17. And those slaves were, two of them were in Kansas, and 15 were in Nebraska. In all of the territories that were eventually claimed by the southern states, there were no slaves. Mm-hmm. So obviously, slavery was not attracted into the territories. It was stopped by geography. But the whole idea behind the repeal of the Missouri Compromise in the Kansas-Nebraska Act was building a railroad. And most American historians will not give you a clue to that. You have to read British historians, and the one that I used, the one that was most most insightful in this respect, was Sir Winston Churchill. That will give you an example of the kind of evidence that is available to explain events of that kind. We talk about John Brown's raid, which was obviously very important. A number of people at the time knew that John Brown couldn't possibly have had the resources to mount that raid himself. We now know in Edward Renahan's book, The Secret Six, and Otto Scott wrote a book by the same title.
That's right.
We know that was a raid that was financed and operated by rich capitalists in New England. And they actually hired John Brown, knowing that he couldn't possibly succeed and that he was going to create trouble. And the purpose was, of course, to generate hostility between the North and the South that otherwise would not have been generated at all.
By the way, they're still financing different groups all across the country to stir up some kind of strife or another today, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly. I mean, political correctness as an example. They're political correctness is financed by institutions on Wall Street. And the purpose of this political correctness is to stir up ill feeling between black and white that would not otherwise exist.
Right.
It would not. What I learned when I was young and visited my aunt and uncle in Alabama, I found that there was much more harmony and good feeling between blacks and whites than there are in my part of the country.
That doesn't bring a lot of money into the coffers of the ACLU and the NAACP, though, if there's harmony, does it?
No, that's right. And of course, this was the way it was with respect to the anti-slavery movement in the North. It was essentially it was not a problem-solving movement so far as it was in the North. It was an educational movement. It was to stir up ill feeling between North and South, between black and white, but the real abolitionists, the ones that were actually going out there and working on phasing slavery out and making jobs available to the new freedmen and so on, those that were doing the whole work of bringing slavery to an end, were all Southerners. James Birney was the example that I was giving you a while back, and there was William Lloyd Garrison, who was a crank. He was from New England, but the Northern movement had degenerated into a kind of pathetic eccentricity. It was a man like James Birney from Alabama who sold his slaves and went up north and gave dignity and voice to the abolition movement and said, "Okay, stop the clowning around and get down to business. You want to free slaves, and we have a lot of work to do." It was the serious abolitionists were all Southerners. That was a great surprise to me, but that is in fact what happens in history. And the Dred Scott case is another example of. That was a case, not many people understand this, but it was a case which began in Missouri, which was a slave state, and Dred Scott brought suit in the Circuit Court of Missouri, a lawyer in Missouri who was helping Dred Scott. He was wanted to donate some services to help the profession. And Dred Scott was freed, and his family were all freed by a Southern judge and a Southern court on the basis of Southern jurisprudence. This is a case that eventually ended up before the United States Supreme Court. It should have never gotten there, but it did. But the case started out by liberation of slaves by Southerners. By the time it got up to the United States Supreme Court, a lot of corrupt influence peddling had taken place, and some of the details about the corrupt influence in the Dred Scott case are brought out in a recent book on the United States Supreme Court by the late William Rehnquist, who was Chief Justice up through 2005.
Right.
The dissents, if you look at the dissents in the Dred Scott case, particularly Benjamin Curtis. Benjamin Curtis was from Massachusetts, but his opinion outlines in 70 pages, over the course of 70 pages, the jurisprudence of the Southern states and showed why, under the jurisprudence of the Southern states, if a black slave became free, he became a citizen of his state. And it was the Southern states that developed the jurisprudence based on the judgment of Lord Mansfield in Somerset's case in 1771, that if you brought your slave into free territory, the slave became free. That was the law on which Dred Scott built his case. All of that law was developed by Southern courts and Southern lawyers and Southern judges.
You certainly don't read that in any textbooks, do you?
Well, no, no, because if you knew the truth, you wouldn't. The political correctness boys would be laughed out of court. The Southern Legal Resources Center, whatever it is, not the Southern Legal Resources.
Southern Poverty Law Center.
That's the Southern Poverty Law. They're agitation.
They're
involved
right.
in agitation, calling Southerners who are more libertarian than they are. As if they were somehow or other interested in bringing about our black brothers and sisters. We're trying to cause them suffering. Well, that certainly isn't true. It's the very opposite of what's the case. If we knew the truth about the Dred Scott case, that Dred Scott was actually free.
Mm-hmm.
And he was then unfreed by the U.S. Supreme Court as a result of influence peddling of big money that wanted to repeal the Missouri Compromise as part of that wanted to keep the Missouri Compromise from being reinstated. These were the big money men that were talking about building railroads. That was what this was all about. And if you don't look at these events carefully, you're likely to be misled and get into the entirely false impression of what actually happened.
Well, that certainly makes sense, not only in light of the fact that the Missouri Compromise had originally put down some very early feelings of secession in the South, but also in 1850 when the subject came up again and the first secession convention in the South was held in Nashville in 1850, the promise by many national politicians to keep the Missouri Compromise in force was what, again, put down those feelings of secession at that time.
It dampened secession, right. It dampened secession. It's a very interesting thing is that I'm living right now in the province of Quebec, and I was the advisor to the lawyer for Quebec before the Supreme Court of Canada in the secession case. I advised him on British constitutional law and history and helped him write his argument. Once the grievances, once the right of secession was conceded by the Supreme Court of Canada, the secession movement died.
Hmm.
Once they began to address the grievances they had a situation in Canada that was very much like we had in the United States with two basic civilizations and cultures. One was a minority, as inevitably happens, but once the assurance of secession is conceded, and once you at the same time seek to address the grievances, it evaporates. The movement for secession evaporates.
And many of our folks have said for years that if all it takes is what you just said for there to be an acceptance of the fact that secession is a legal option, and generally speaking, when that's acknowledged by all the parties involved, there rarely is a need for it.
That's because everyone then understands that it's time to reconcile.
That's
right. I mean, if you the moment the people who were causing the secession movement in Quebec to become dangerously volatile were those who were denying the right of secession. The ones who resolved the secession crisis were the ones who conceded the right of secession and then immediately came out and sought to address it. That's what happened in Quebec in our own time. The same thing, if, for example, in 1860, Lincoln had conceded the right of secession, there wouldn't have ever been a secession.
Mm-hmm.
And there would have been instead of attempting to antagonize the South, there would have been serious efforts to reconcile with the South. That was a point that Alexander Stevens of Georgia made. You're no doubt familiar with his
I am, yes, sir.
With Stevens, I one time made a little pilgrimage to his Liberty Hall. I think he was one of the great men. Interestingly, I was a young lawyer in Minnesota, and I was doing a lot of criminal trials, and when I was in the federal courthouse and the state courthouse were right close by, and there was an old bookstore not far, and I would, between cases, you know, you have a lull of several hours, I'd go over there and browse in their books. I came across Alexander Stevens' constitutional view of the late war between the states, and when I read that changed my whole... that was when I started to learn about the Constitution. I really didn't understand it when I was studying it in law school.
Well, now, Jack, we've talked about some of these events that the men behind the scenes used to lead us to the war.
Yes.
What were some of those events that they used during the war and all the way up to the early 20th century to actually go forward with their money takeover itself?
Mm-hmm. You're familiar with the Hazard Circular, are you not?
No, sir. I have to plead ignorance on that.
Well, the Hazard Circular was a circular that was used by the promoters, by the those who were selling bonds, and they pointed out that we cannot control greenbacks, but if we can get currency based upon war bonds, then we can gain control of the money of the monetary system, and we want you to buy these war bonds so that you can get in for the. You can. We know that the Secretary of Treasury is going to be offering legislation in what became the National Bank Acts of 1863 and 1864. We know that we can. What the Secretary of Treasury is going to do. That was Salmon P. Chase.
Right.
And Salmon P. Chase was a, if I may use the term, a political prostitute. He was the one who engineered the sale of the war bonds and the conversion. The key was not only to buy the war bonds, I mean, the South sold war bonds too, but the key was was to get the war bonds, because the legislation that was passed in the National Bank Act of 1863 and 1864 enabled the legislation provided that at least a third of your capital basis has to be these war bonds. It was if you had only gold and silver coin, you couldn't set up a national bank. You had to buy war bonds. So those war bonds became a principal and obligatory capital basis. These banks had extraordinary privileges. Once they were set up, for example, the banknotes of the state banks were taxed out of circulation. So that the currency consisted of gold and silver coin, greenbacks, and national banknotes. The state banks then had to keep their reserves with the national banks. The national banks had their reserves with central reserve banks in New York City on Wall Street. That was one of the most important things. Another thing that was done was to demonetize silver in the latter part of the 19th century and make gold the primary currency, purpose being to enhance the value of the national debt in the hands of those who owned it.
And that was the fight on the side of liberty was led by William Jennings Bryan.
Exactly.
During that.
Exactly. Yeah, you've read his. You're certainly familiar with his Cross of Gold speech.
I'm vaguely familiar with it. I certainly couldn't give you the contents of it.
Well, I talk both in my little monograph or book, which is not really very long, but it's it's very compact. It took me 4 years to write 100 pages because it was so difficult, conceptually so difficult, to put it down in a way that would... But I talk about the Hazard Circular and William Jennings Bryan's speech, where he... What his object was to monetize silver at 16 to 1. And that would essentially get overvalued silver in relation to gold and would have led to silver would have become the dominant money of the United States.
Right.
That would have been a money that was outside the control of those who owned the national bank system, and it would have facilitated the retirement of the debt, which was generated by the Civil War, and would have struck a fairer balance between debtors and creditors in the United States because there was an undersupply of money at that time. And that was why they demonetized silver, starting with the Coinage Act of 1873. The other key event was the setting up of the national bank system based upon war bonds. That was the war bonds that brought specie or gold and silver coin into the federal treasury. On the other side, the South had financed their war effort pretty much as the Continental Congress had financed the Revolution by just the issuance of paper currency.
Right.
The strength of the Northern war effort was due primarily to the fact that the big banking houses in Europe, which had plenty of specie to use for the purchase of war bonds, and through using their affiliates in the United States, August Belmont, Jay Cook, and characters of that sort, they were able to provide the kind of glitter, the kind of currency that would enable the North to conduct a serious war effort and overwhelm the South. The South didn't have enough specie, and that's why they were overwhelmed. Alexander Stevens has a lot to say about this. General Joseph Johnston, was certainly had a lot to say about it. Another one that knew a lot about this was Judah Benjamin,
right,
from Louisiana.
Well, of course, those events of creating that federal banking system led ultimately to the creation of the Federal Reserve Act. And
the Federal Reserve Act was simply an act that formalized and legalized the banking cartel that had been established on Wall Street from the financing of the Civil War. That was a point that Charles Lindbergh made in his book, Banking Currency and the Money Trust, that was published in 1913, when he was almost single-handedly resisting the efforts to pass the Federal Reserve Act in Congress.
I mean, that was
my
understanding.
He wanted good banking legislation, but not that kind.
Right. Well, we certainly don't have time to go into all of the details of the story behind the creation of the Federal Reserve System and everything tonight. We're already here right up almost on an hour. But what I would like to do is come back after a very short break here. And, Jack, if we could, let's kind of wrap things up let folks know where we're at today with all this. And is there a hope? A solution still out there to remedy these problems that have been created by the moneyed men, and then we'll find out.
Oh, yes, there is a solution.
Great. Well, folks, you don't want to miss it. We're talking to John Remington Graham about his new book with Pelican Publishing entitled Blood Money, The Civil War and the Federal Reserve, and it gives you the detailed information, the evidence, if you will, about how these men not only orchestrated the series of events that led to the war itself, but then once the war was upon us, they created the events that led to the complete money takeover of these United States. So take a look at it. It's on the Pelican website. You can look at it by going to epelican.com, click on the browse button, and type in the title of the book, Blood Money, or you can type in the author's name, John Remington Graham, and look at it for yourself. You can even purchase a copy of the book at a reduced price there on the Pelican website while you're listening to the interview. We'll be back in just a minute to wrap things up, so don't go anywhere. You want to hear the concluding remarks tonight.
Dixie Outfitters franchise stores now offer a whole new way to shop for your favorite Southern apparel. Service has always been a hallmark trait of Dixie Outfitters, and now we've stepped it up a notch by bringing you Dixie Outfitters franchise stores in select markets. Places where you can walk into an actual store and shop to your heart's content with Dixie Outfitters merchandise from wall to wall. Hats, jeans, shorts, jackets, all of your favorite Dixie Outfitter t-shirts, plus a whole lot more. Check out our website for franchise locations. And if you've been thinking about opening your own business, what investment can be better than your own Dixie Outfitters franchise store? Territories are exclusive, so the number of franchises available is limited. For information, call us toll-free at 1-866-916-5866 or visit our website at DixieOutfitters.com and drop us an email.
Okay.
This is Ray McBerry, and we're back with the concluding remarks here of this Pelican Pages segment, and we're talking to John Remington Graham. He's given us permission to call him Jack tonight, so we're talking to Jack Graham about his book from Pelican Publishing, Blood Money, The Civil War and the Federal Reserve. And Jack, it's been a very educational interview tonight for me, because I've learned things from reading your book and a few extra things from talking to you on the broadcast tonight, and definitely would like to get you back up on the broadcast sometime. I know we're going to have folks that are going to be emailing us or calling us and letting us know that we should have planned for this interview to be a little bit longer than it is. But as we wrap it up tonight, we don't want to give everybody all the information anyway, because they ought to go out and buy the book.
Well, that would be a good thing, because it's not that long.
And, folks, you can actually buy it on the Pelican website, as we've already said, or you could probably go down to your closest major bookseller and probably find it right on the bookshelf there. Pelican does a tremendous job of promoting and distributing their new works. And if they don't have it on the shelf at your local bookstore, I guarantee you they can order it and have it there within just a couple of days. So the title is Blood Money, The Civil War and the Federal Reserve. Jack, as we wrap things up tonight, we've talked about how the moneyed men orchestrated all these events in American history to take over the financial system of America. Is that where we're still at today?
Well, sure, because the Federal Reserve Act installed, basically what it did was to give the largest financial institutions, which control the Federal Reserve District of New York, control over the whole system. Now, this what gives them, this gives them the power to expand and contract the money supply. That fundamentally dictates what our investments must be, and they also control. There are very learned works on how the press is controlled in this country. The same institutions that control the Federal Reserve District of New York, which is the hub of the Federal Reserve System, which in turn expands and contracts our money supply and determines what our investments are going to be, also have direct or indirect control of the news media. And that gives them control over who we get to choose for president. Right now they're giving us a choice between Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani.
What great choices.
Well, I mean, that doesn't make a lot of people very happy. Well, why is it that they get to choose that? But they actually get to to choose this. Do you remember in 1996 when Pat Buchanan won New Hampshire primary for president?
I do.
And 2 weeks, two or three weeks, he was completely marginalized by the news media. And Senator Dole became the Republican nominee. That type of thing repeats itself all the time. If you watch the political life of this country, the way they control it is that they control both major parties. They dictate their agenda. They have control over our educational system because they determine who is going to be able to pick the Secretary of Agriculture and the Secretary of Education and the funding and the programs of teaching. They are the ones who are behind the attempts to secularize public education and to eliminate any and all religious instruction, which in effect leaves us with secular humanism.
That's right.
They are the ones who set the population control agenda. They are the ones that have done all of that. In fact, they are the ones that encouraged the failure to protect our borders on the south so that we have an excess of immigration right now from Mexico. A lot of these people from Mexico are very good for the United States, but you can only accept so much immigration at a time, and that's obviously gotten out of hand. All of this business of high finance, the free trade, NAFTA and all of that business, that is all the agenda of high finance. And the institutions that in order to have that kind of power, it's enough to say we can expand and contract the money supply and we have control of the press so that we can sway 10% of the vote in every election. That is enough to give them control over the country and make them an invisible government. That is what Charles Lindbergh Sr. Said was going to happen and why he opposed the Federal Reserve System. We need strong banking and we need wise economics, and we cannot get along without a sound monetary system. We probably need a federal. Need a central bank. Although there are those who will question that, but let's concede for the sake of discussion that we need a central bank. That central bank should be owned and controlled by the government of the United States. It should be subject to public authority and audit, and it should not be in the hands of a small elite. It should have the kinds of policies that would be beneficial to small business and a free enterprise. Instead, we have an oligarchy, a financial oligarchy that runs the country. That's because of the way of the advantage that has been gained from the financial oligarchy or an empire on Wall Street that grew up from the financing of the American Civil War. There are ways of dismantling this system. We could nationalize the Federal Reserve for a couple billion dollars in greenbacks. We could nationalize it. That would cancel 1/4 of our national debt right there. We could switch from Federal Reserve notes to U.S. notes, pay off the bonds and U.S. notes, and counteract the inflation. We could raise the reserve requirements in our national banking institutions, and eventually we could bring ourselves out of it. I discussed this somewhat in the book to show that there is a solution. The question that we have to accomplish first is to appreciate what we have to do now is to appreciate what has actually happened to us, who is running this and why, and how it all started. It all started with the Civil War, and that's what I'm discussing in the book.
Well, you know, Jack, one of the most interesting plausible solutions that I find in your book at the end is a discussion of the numerous modern-day secession movements springing up all across the continent.
Oh, yes. There are a lot of... There's a very interesting one in New England.
Up in Vermont.
Yes, yes. And I know those people. And interesting, the value of secession is that once it becomes, it acquires critical mass, invariably, once that begins to happen, you find that the grievances that generate those movements start to be become known, and then they can be solved. But until that happens, people don't listen. The thing that happened in Quebec was the most amazing story that I ever saw. The right of secession caused Anglo-Canada to see the need to reconcile, which they did. And they have a prime minister in Canada right now who has made certain that, I mean, he said that I'm going to make peace with Quebec. We're going to address these grievances now that the secession movement has gotten some critical mass. And he did. Hmm. And now Canada is united and strong from sea to sea. The same thing could happen to the United States. But part of the solution, oddly enough, is recognizing that that secession is a real possibility.
Well, Jack, I appreciate you being on the broadcast with us tonight. I know I've kept you on longer than we promised we would do, but you've opened up so many topics that we haven't even had time to delve into. We're definitely going to have you back.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And because this is a Pelican Pages segment, if you would, tell us a little bit about how you met Dr. Calhoun and how you came to choose Pelican Publishing as your publisher for this book.
Well, I met Dr. Calhoun at an institute. It was a League of the South Institute for the Study of Southern Culture and History, I believe. It was in a private home in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, at the home of Mary Elizabeth Sanders, a very dear old friend. I gave a paper on the Dred Scott case, and a paper on why Salmon P. Chase appears on the $10,000 bill. And Dr. Calhoun was there. We got to talking and became quite engaged in our discussion. Dr. Calhoun is a very well-read, intellectually curious individual, and that's one reason why he's in the book business. You know.
I can imagine.
Well, he's an old country doctor. You know, he's a country doctor, and he's very wise in that way. But his family has been in the publishing business for some time, and it was because of my discussion of the Dred Scott case that I think he was attracted to some of my ideas, and he offered to publish a book that I was working on, and that was A Constitutional History of Secession. And then once that book got out, a number of people became very, very curious about the statements that I made in the book, but did not fully exploit, about the financial and monetary causes behind the Civil War. That led to an invitation to publish the book that I'm writing now, that we just talked about tonight. And now I'm working on a third book for Dr. Calhoun. I just signed the contract. It will be called Free, Sovereign, and Independent States, which are the words that were used by King George III when he granted American independence in 1783 to describe the United States. And I'm writing now a comprehensive treatise on every provision of the original Constitution of the United States that was framed in Philadelphia in 1787.
Great. Any idea when we can expect that?
Well, I think it will be published in the year 2009. So
great.
We have great. Some time to, but it's a very, this is a this book is something that I could not have written when I was more active in my career, because you can't do that. This is a book that I've been working on all my 40 years as a lawyer. So now I'm putting it all together and integrating a lifetime of study. So you're going to will understand what the original Constitution actually looked like. And there are many big surprises about what the framers intended about this and that. They made a lot of interesting mistakes, but they also did a lot of very fascinating things. And interestingly, you can't say that the Confederate nature of our Constitution, as it was originally intended, was something that was from the South. A lot of the Southerners were for a big central government. It sounds strange, but there were. James Madison was for a big central government. It was a lot of New Englanders were the ones that are responsible for the decentralized character. Now, once that generation died out, we have a new generation. It was the South who realized that what we have and capitalized on it.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of interesting quirks in history, but this book is going to be going to try to state the intended meaning of the whole United States Constitution, and it will be like the book of my friend Dr. DeRosa, whose recent book on the Confederate Constitution
has just
been out, and it will be a book to be used that will enable, as his book will help us understand the Confederate Constitution as a model for framing constitutions of the future. I'm hoping that my book on the intended meaning of the United States Constitution will help us better understand, and maybe Europe better understand how to frame a constitution that would make some sense. They certainly have been floundering up till now.
Tremendous. Well, we'll certainly be looking forward to that with anticipation, and we hope to maybe be able to have you back on the broadcast between now and then and cover some of these other subjects that we really haven't had time to delve into tonight,
mm-hmm.
Because there's certainly some of the topics that are the keys to understanding where we are today, and hopefully the keys to understanding some of the solutions too.
Well, Ray, I would love to do that, and it's been a great pleasure to be on your show, and I always like to talk to a Southerner. Your accent is music to my ears, because it reminds me of the Southerners in my family.
Well, I'm afraid that Secular College did their best to get that Southern accent out of me. I'm trying to find some of the pieces.
Back. You're doing fine.
Well, folks, you've been listening to another Pelican Pages segment here at Dixie Broadcasting. I am your host, Ray McBerry, and I've been joined tonight with John Remington Graham, who is the author of Blood Money, The Civil War and the Federal Reserve. It's a book that gives you some of the details about how the men behind the scenes orchestrated those events that caused the war, and then orchestrated the events during and after the war for a complete money takeover of the financial systems of America. It's a book that you'll find entertaining and certainly educational, and one that you can purchase right off the Pelican website by going to ePelican.com, or you can go to your local bookstore and either find it on the shelf or they can order it from Pelican and have it for you probably within 3 days. So, folks, take a look at the book, Blood Money, by John Remington Graham. Thanks again, Jack, for being on the show with us tonight.
Oh, thank you, Ray.
And, folks, we've got plenty more coming up tonight, so stay tuned right here to your favorite Southern radio station, Dixie Broadcasting.